was then to Miss Sister Hart, I'm sure. If ever there was a person who was true and faithful, it was Sister Hart. Think of all the months and years she got up all by herself at 3 o'clock in the morning to go up to the temple. People would drag out after I can't imagine anyone of such faithfulness as that. It's just staggering. And I'm sure when they came to get her, she was willing to go too, and eager to go. And I think the rest of us would be too. We ever got afraid. We will, don't worry. We're on the 22nd verse here, right in the middle of the 103rd section. And the saints are told to go now in the 22nd verse and gather yourselves together upon the land which I have bought with money, which has been consecrated to me. They're to take possession. They're to take a formal legal possession is what they're supposed to do. Gathering there in their strength and clearing their titles for whatever was to come. And what about bought with money? Well, that's the title of Mashavi. Remember this. This means so even Satan himself cannot challenge their right. Since that is his argument, we have to be in the clear of these things all the way. This looker. Has he any right to this earth? Has Satan any right to this earth? There is a remarkable story. It's the founding legend of the Hopis. I've heard it from a number of them. In fact, the first time I ever went down there, old Tom Kuyushko was 104 years old when he finally died. He was the first elder when they came back into the church in numbers in the 1940s with Brother Virgil Bushman. And it's the story, well, to cut it short, they pay tithes to Satan and they pay tithes to the church too, the members of the church. Well, now why should they pay tithes to Mashavi? They call him Mashavi. It's a very interesting story here. The reason the story is so interesting is exactly the same story is told about the Jews when David went and wanted to build the temple on Mount Moriah. He reached the same agreement, and the Jews always paid 10% to Satan for the rent of the Temple Mountain, because he has a claim to this earth. They say, yes, he is the prince of this earth. And they would pay their tithe to him, and they pay their tithe to the church too, the tithe to Mashavi. They said, because he is. They say, oh yes, he has been allowed permission to rule this earth. He has been given a franchise to operate business here. We will allow Satan, our common enemy, to try men and to tempt him. So he's here and he's operating. And we have to clear a title with him too. And the Jews always pay the tithe for the rent of the mountain of the temple on which the temple stood. That's to be until the Lord comes.
Oh, here's some other books.
Yes. That's a strange, perverse order of things that we should be engaging in such sordid business and so forth. But it's always been so from the very beginning. We're supposed to make friends with the mammon of unrighteousness for a particular purpose, we're told here. But if Satan has a franchise to operate on this earth, then we immediately ask, well, what good would it do him after all? He can't take possession. He has no body as far as that goes. He has no temporal body. He can only act on this earth through his agents. He can carry on business, but he does it through his agents. And he knows very well how he can entice God's children into acting as such. That's his business. Try men and tempt them. Well, while we are here, we're told, you remember, agree with thine enemy when thou art in the way with him, and we pay our way through here in the world's coin. Have you any money? We have sufficient for our needs. There's nothing wrong with it as such. You have sufficient for your needs. Who is that who says that? Heavenly visitors, while they're here. When they're here, they're challenged. We're told that even the angels themselves are challenged when they're here. And this is what throughout the Middle Ages, the Jews were only too willing to pay the tithes. Well, in order to move anywhere, it's just so with pilgrims. You don't realize this. Do you realize that there is not a single act of the Roman Catholic Church which approves pilgrimage? It's always been opposed by the Roman Catholic Church. And say, well, pilgrimage is a basic Christian institution. Everybody was going back to what the Crusades were fought about and so forth. Everybody's going back to Jerusalem. Everybody was making pilgrimage. Well, haven't you read Chaucer? We have to go to Our Lady of Walsingham, and we have to go to Canterbury, and we have to go to St. James of Compostela, all making pilgrimage. This was against the will and teaching of the Roman Church. We have many statements against it. In the 4th century, all the fathers of the Church pronounced very strongly against it. Gregory of Nazianzus does, and Basil does. They all do. John Chrysostom, They had nothing to say in good, in the favor of pilgrimage. And they had much to say about how bad it was, of course. It was not only a strenuous and wasteful thing, but the pilgrimage centers were places where the pilgrims were always fleeced, they were always taken to the cleaners, and places of great immorality, away from home, it was like a convention, and all sorts of unpleasant things happened. Well, what was this business of pilgrimage? Well, the reason the church always opposed it, and in a number of acts opposed it, was because it was a vote of no confidence in the church. People were looking for the original church. They were looking for the original, to get back to the original, not only the organization, but the scenes where the ancient saints lived, and above all, the original object of pilgrimage from the 2nd century on, as early as the 2nd century, the pilgrimage was to the Mount of Olives, where there was the footprint of Jesus. Now, you know throughout the world, how do I get on pilgrimage? I'll tell you why. It has to do with this. It has to do with this. But we're making our pilgrimage here, and in these parts of the Doctrine and Covenants, the saints are told, you must make your deal with the world. You must make your peace with the world. Anything to keep out of court. If he asks you to go with a mile, go within 2 miles. If he asks for your coat, give him your cloak, and so forth. Anything to avoid trouble. Be willing to pay the price and settle with him. Pay Satan's own price here, so that he will never have a case against you. Pay up as far as you go. So this is what the pilgrims used to do. But I say it was a vote of no confidence. They'd go to the top of the Mount of Olives, and that was the original end of all pilgrimage. We have some wonderful accounts. The Bordeaux pilgrimage in the 4th century, and even earlier than that, a lady called Sylvia, a remarkable woman, real name was Itheria. She was a woman from Gaul, a rich, one of these overpowering personalities of woman. She went everywhere, and she's given us her account of her pilgrimage. It's marvelous. She visited all the holy places. She went all over Sinai, all over Israel, all over everywhere else, you know, everywhere you had to go. And was she a dominating woman? She completely intimidated the guides wherever she went. And if the place was closed or not allowed to women, she would just sweep them aside and go in the grand manner. She was this imperious Gaulish woman who would really take things over. We have some very full accounts of what went on in these early pilgrimages and how they moved in on them and so forth. But again, the object was that footprint on the mount, top of the Mount of Olives, because this was the last place where the Lord was seen. And the people would go up there and look up into the sky and shed tears of sorrow, and where did the Lord go? Is he coming back? This is what they were looking for, waiting for the return of the Lord. And we have some remarkably early accounts of that. They were always very sorrowful. And the nearer they got to the holy places, the more sorrowful, so that the morning, as the Lady Aetherius tells us, as Sylvia says, when they got to the Holy Sepulchre and the Mount of Olives, the mourning and the howling and the weeping and wailing was absolutely deafening. She says it was terrifying. What strange thing was this going on? Is people trying to get back something they had lost. This feeling of terrible loss was what dominated. The pilgrim was looking for something. He was searching for something which was lost. So the church disapproved it and did everything they could to discourage it. Well, now we get some fighting words, some militant words, these 14 to 28. But it talks about cursing the land, about avenging and laying down one's life and so forth. But wait, he's going to tell us what he means here. And there's a catch to it. This is an action program implied, but it's not an alternative to the patience and long-suffering he's just recommended in the preceding verses, just above this. We won't review them now. It's only justified for those who have kept all the commandments concerning the restoration and reception of Zion and redemption of Zion. If you've kept all the commandments, then this thing takes on a very different light. Remember, he has just given them all these very particular commandments, and remember the terms in which this ends, which is, well, where which is that they're to the next section, to sue for peace at all times. But notice, this includes the most severe self-restraint. He just said 70 times 7, forbearance. You shall forgive your neighbors. Remember in the preceding section, just before this, he says how forbearing you should be. And after you've kept all the commandments, then you do this. They're not to infiltrate as before. Remember, they had been moving out on a massive missionary front before, moving separately so they could cover more ground, visit more houses, and spread the gospel as they went. They infiltrated into the west, into Missouri. But now they're to go in companies. They're moving fast. It's sort of a little blitz here. They're to go in strength and to go in companies. Behold, this is my will. Very interesting, this 31st verse. Behold, this is my will. But men do not always do my will. They're not going to do it. And they'll not be forced to do it either, for that matter. If you can't get 300 to go, get as many as you can, he says. But get at least 100. Don't go without a group of less than 100. This was the Zion's camp, you see. And when he's there, Joseph Smith might establish a real reestablishing of Zion in the 35th section. If you ask and pray earnestly, that peradventure he might. Notice there is nothing hard and fast here. He will not promise everything. It is their training, it is their conditioning, just as he could have taken Lehi and his company through the air in a few hours, the way we can do it today, from the old world to the new. He could have got over here without the greatest of ease. 8 years they had to spend in the wilderness. They had the terrible beating they had to take to do it. But it was for their benefit, isn't it? Not that the Lord couldn't do it if he wanted to. It's the same thing here. You are the one that's being tried. I'm not making you anything. It's no hard and fast situation here. It all depends on you, notice here. If you ask and pray earnestly, perchance I might just do it for you. That peradventure he might. Give you this thing in the 35th verse here. And ye shall receive. Pray earnestly that peradventure my servant Barak Ali and Barak Ale, there's Joseph Smith, say a very interesting name there. Barak Ale has nothing to do with Baraka to bless. Remember, Professor Super up to you if you said, oh, Joseph Smith didn't understand. He probably got this word from the word Barak Ale, showing how ignorant Zucker was, because Barak Ale is the word that's used for Enoch in many ancient texts. Of course, this wasn't known at that time. God's lightning was the epithet for Enoch, and Joseph Smith has just been referred to twice as Enoch, as the founder and leader of Zion was Enoch. Of course, he's leading the new Zion. This was Zion's camp. So what is he called? As Enoch. Now, why was Enoch given this? Remember, in the days of Enoch were terrible times. The heavens wept and the lightnings descended, and there were great upheavals for a generation preceding the great flood, and this preparation took place, Enoch leading the people amid the storm. But Enoch, when he was on his many missions, but when he was on the mission of leading the people out, of leading them out under times of great stress and strain, then he appropriately is designated by the title of God's lightning, the man in the lightning, of Barak Ale. The Barak, of course, Barak is lightning, and Ale is God. And in the same place, Joseph Smith is leading Zion's camp, and he's called Barak Ale. Now, nobody had the vaguest idea of what the significance of that title was. See, these names he gives are really quite significant. They're encoded. We're just beginning to discover that there is something behind these things. The Lord has his purposes here. And as he's going to tell us in the 105th section, he says, you'll find this all in the book of Enoch, which shall be revealed in due time. It hadn't been given at that time. And so we get some hints of it here. We get rumblings here. They go with you and preside in the midst. That might be so. Joseph Smith might be able to go with you and preside in the midst of my people and organize my kingdom upon the consecrated land and establish the children of Zion upon the laws and commandments which have been given and which shall be given you. Notice here is the same thing. This one verse is so compact. It says we might be able to pull it off right now for adventure. If you pray humbly and do this thing, the prophet has the authority. He has the power to do it. Will it be done? Well, and notice the conditions here and the things that have to be fulfilled. But how badly did the people really want the prophet to organize my kingdom upon consecrated land? Just talked about that before, not to be used for traffic. The people all observing the laws and commandments which I have been and shall be given. At that time, Brigham Young said, and he refers to this particular event, Brigham Young said, at that time, the people were as far from accepting the commandments as the East is from the West, he says. They weren't ready for that at all. The Lord knew that. This is indicated all the way along here, and later on, too. Then why? Why present them with the whole proposition prematurely here, in this 35th verse? Why say you can set the whole thing up and get it going right now? Why premature? So that they could be led without excuse. They're given the complete offer. He offers them the complete package here. Now, here it is. You can have it. You can have it right now. He's going to say in the next verse, I would have redeemed you right now. Could have done it. And again, Brigham Young says, we could have had in 1 year what we've had to fight and pray and suffer for 30 years. We could have had it all in 1 year. This is the way we have to go through it. And so he says here, they could never say to him, well, you never told us how it would be, what blessings we might have. You didn't give us the whole thing. If we had only known. You can't say that. Here it is. I'm giving it all to you now. And so you can't say, well, you never had a chance. You didn't show us what blessings awaited and so forth. No. All victory and glory is brought to pass. Now he's telling us how. Not through a military operation. This is Zion's camp. They're not going to wipe to use any strong arm at all. Through your diligence, faithfulness, and the prayers of faith. These brethren are to follow Joseph Smith's instruction in obtaining the fulfillment of these commands. Everything must be carried out and leave the residue in my hands. They're instructed to follow orders strictly and not take things into their own hands. Remember, a company, this is a paramilitary company, it actually is, from 300 to 100, moving through the land here. And again, this is not a unique phenomenon. Remember, there were the movements, the pioneer movements at this time, were very restless in very many. I say it culminates in the Jayhawks and Bushwhackers and so forth, and you get these big mob movements become really dangerous and lead right up to the Civil War, which is just a big clash of ignorant armies by night. It's a mob action, too, as far as that goes. But they're not to take things over. Leave it all in my hands, as they're instructed. You do what I tell you and leave the rest to me. Now, in this next section, he gets very specific. The whole thing has been what they wanted to do, to establish both in Zion to the west, in Missouri, Liberty, and back in Kirtland, was to establish the United Order, and they were to be a single society in the church. The one was to be extension of the other. They were to phase out Kirtland and move into Missouri, but now here they're separate. They're divided into separate societies. He does not rescind the United Order here, but he rescinds the uniting of the whole church. So you can have two of them here. We'll see what happens here. They're not ready for it yet, but he says that's no excuse, because you are ready for it now. It has not been given prematurely. He says some very specific things about it here, things that make us rather uncomfortable with it. Maybe we'll begin to realize our lesson if the pressure stays on the way it's building up in these days. Well, this is the council and the commandment concerning the United Order, and here he calls it by name, which is not a tentative order, it's an everlasting order. You say, well, this is temporary, it'll see us in a certain phase of church history and so forth. No, it's an everlasting order. Not for some future time either, but to save the church now, going into operation for the benefit of my church, and for the salvation of men until I had come. The people could not believe it, couldn't accept it. Still don't. If observed, God promises in the next verse, the second verse, the 104th section now, that it'll always work. He says it will always work. And by it, the people should be blessed with a multiplicity of blessings, with a promise immutable and unchangeable, that inasmuch as those whom I have commanded were faithful, they should be blessed. It's an immutable and unchangeable promise. This will always work if you try. Those who embrace the gospel are to be held to it. Inasmuch as they were not faithful, they were nigh unto cursing. They're very strong. Don't say I curse them, but they're coming awfully close to it here. They're asking for it. Well, can it be postponed? No. Those who fail to keep it here and now are denounced. Inasmuch as some of my servants have not kept my commandment, but have broken the covenant, I have cursed them with a very sore and grievous curse. It's pretty strong language here. They have not kept it. They didn't. He tells us why. We read those passages from, as I say, from various journals, contemporary accounts of Heber C. Kimball, Wilford Woodruff, from the rest, Parley P. Pratt, people who were present at the time, and Joseph Smith himself, and Edward Stevenson, very good on this particular thing. So that's exactly what happened. They went into business, they went into real estate, and forgot all about that sort of thing. The prophet could not bring them around. That was all there was to it. They thought they were in and they had it made, and they were going to move in and take over. And did that backfire? Well, they have not. Now, well, why would they want to disregard it after accepting the gospel? Have not kept my commandments and have broken the covenant. Well, he says, this is why. Through covetousness and feigned words. They were greedy, and they covered up their greed with smooth talk. Feigned words means hypocrisy, pretending to accept what they didn't really accept. They were being hypocritical through their greed and hypocrisy. What made them break this and not keep it, while they pretended to keep it. See, it is the feigned word. They feigned to be going along with it. They weren't. They were really covetous. They wanted stuff for themselves. They were doing. If any man belong to the order, the next order, shall break the covenant with which ye are bound, he shall be cursed in his life, and shall be trodden down by whom I will. In this case, it happened to be the mob, and this was the time when the church underwent the worst of all its persecutions, because they have not been true. They have broken the covenant with which they were bound. And speaking of the those who paid lip service in the sixth verse here, do it while seeking gain. Who do you think you're fooling, the Lord says, with your feigned talk? I, the Lord, am not to be mocked in these things. You can't make fun of me. Make the covenant. And the innocent and the guilty are mingled in the Latter-day Saint community. Not all of these are some of you have done that. In the seventh verse, he makes it clear here. And this, that the innocent among you shall not be condemned to the unjust, that the guilty among you may not escape. It works both ways. This doesn't give a way out to the guilty, nor does it bring condemnation on the innocent. The guilty are not rendered pure by membership and association. You don't become innocent by association, and you don't become guilty by association either. In other words, your membership doesn't make that much difference. It's not because you're a member that you're automatically in the clear, and it's the non-members that are bad, the members that are good. Not it at all. It's in the church itself. There are those who are guilty, and they are not to be let off just because they're members of the church. And on the other hand, they are innocent people who are not to be condemned just because they have to associate with these others. They do. They're all together. Are we? Yeah.
This order is in order of the mob being back here in verse
7? Which one? Because. I don't think the mob is referred to as an order.
5.
Ah, 5. I, the Lord, have decreed in my heart that if any man belong to the order, no, this united order, and be found transgressor and not keeping the laws of the order, transgressor is not keeping the covenants he accepted. See, we covenanted and promised to observe and keep the law of consecration as contained in the Doctrine and Covenants. This is the book we're talking about here. And we don't do it. Still don't, so we can expect trouble. This is not the case of merely getting by in the world. Notice, the only objective is the highest possible objective. See, this is the law of consecration is not an economic law at all, I don't think. And economic is very impractical, as a matter of fact. We'll have evidence for that in a minute. But it's a law of living in the eternities, where we're not concerned with those things, as far as that goes. It's something else. But what we have in mind here, notice here, is the crown of glory at the right hand. That's in a different dimension entirely. I have promised unto you prosperity, success, you'll get it. Well, none of that at all. A crown of glory at my right hand. That's way up there. That's something else now. That's what you're after. Totally different. Don't think you can get away with it, he says in the 8th verse. Inasmuch as you're found transgressor, you cannot escape my wrath in your lives. Here, as well as in the judgment to come. Not get away with it. If you're caught red-handed and cut off for transgression, people are very gross instances. In that case, you cannot escape the buffetings of Satan. Now, the church doesn't punish people for that. They're not to be punished by the church at all. They're delivered to the buffetings of Satan. The only punishment the church administers at all is excommunicate. It pronounces no other penalty, you notice, as it says in the 9th verse here. As much as you're cut off for transgression, you cannot escape the buffetings of Satan. Now, the sentence for transgressing the order, it tells us in the 10th verse, is this. Stand a transgressor and repenteth not of the evil, ye shall deliver him over to the bufferings of Satan, and he shall not have power to bring evil upon him. That's all you do. It's Satan who gives him the bufferings, you don't. We're not called upon to do that at all. It's the only punishment you do. These hysterical people and so forth, like Miss Johnson, they have their lumps, believe me, and they're very unhappy, of course. Quite a number of cases in which that's happened. Story of Mrs. Brody. You all know about Mrs. Brody. Russell Rich here was on a mission back east. Russell Rich. And his companion were called one night in a terrible storm after Mrs. Brody had come out with her book and so forth to go and administer to Mrs. Brody. She was very sick. She's pregnant. She was very sick indeed, and called for the elders to administer to him all these. It was a terrible storm, and they had to drive 80 miles to get to they didn't want to do that. They say, well, can't we wait till the morning? No, her husband, who is Brody, this clever Jewish fellow, and a very worldly type, to say the least. No, he insisted the elves should come right now, so they came out, and he met them at the door, and she said, now, she doesn't believe in this. She's denounced it, so forth. She's made light of it. Why should we minister? He said, leave that up to her. That's for her to say. She insists on it. So they went in, and they said the same thing to her. You don't want us to minister to you, do you? Because you don't believe this. And she said, oh, but I do believe this. She said, and so they administered to her. And less than a week later, they went back. And she and Lolita Brooks were together, and they were having sort of a party. And she met them at the door with a cigarette perfectly well. She was healed. And she came to the door, and she laughed gaily and said, wasn't I silly the other night? It's like that. After she was so desperate, she prayed, do I do believe? And she was healed. And just like that, well, such a person you deliver to the bufflings of Satan. You can believe that. I don't think she is. Well, no, that's not our effect. The person wants to do that, you see. What do you do in a case? You don't do anything. But you do nothing, and yet not judge. See, the elders did administer, as far as that. He had a right for that. She insisted on it. But she must take the consequence in that case. Well, there are other instances, the same sort of thing. But now is the time, we're told here in the 11th verse. The commandment that ye shall organize yourselves and appoint every man his stewardship. Now we talk about stewardship. These are the sections on stewardship that are so important, which makes every man accountable to whom? To me. Every man accountable unto me. As a steward over earthly blessings, which I have made and prepared for my creatures. They are all gifts. They are free gifts of God. We administer them. That's what they are. We don't create anything. We simply grab it, or we administer it, take charge of it, and so forth. Some people are better at that than others. They're the ones who should be doing the administering. The Lord says, this is the way it's going to be done. Just the way I want it to be done. A steward over earthly blessings. He says he produced every bit of it. All things therein are mine. And the earthly things which I have made and prepared for my creatures. Remember, the earth was supplied when we came here. All these things have been supplied miraculously by a process that is quite marvelous. There's nothing we can do about it. He's going to talk about it. This allotting section to come also. So all things there in their mind. The joke they tell about the old, I don't know what his name used to tell about the old Danishman down in Sandpete. The bishop comes along, well, Brother Peterson, that's a fine carrot crop you and the Lord have there. Brother Peter says, yes, you should have seen what it was like, but the Lord was doing it alone. It was his carrot crop. He made the carrot crop. Well, don't fool yourself. It was the Lord's carrot crop. And it is my purpose to provide for my saints, for all things are mine. He's telling us very clearly. I have my own way of doing things. It is all mine. I am in charge. I'm going to distribute these to my saints, and I want you to do it my way. And here, see, he gives us everything. This is a good young musician now. It's a good one, see. When we come here to school. We come to school, and our room and board is paid up when we come here. Well, what do you think of a person who spends all his time at school studying nothing else but how to get more room and board? That's a strange reason why we came to school. That has been provided. Or what do we think of the Lord who's given us everything? He gives us everything as a free gift, and we spend all our days fighting among ourselves to see who can grab the most. Well, after all, he says, you shall have sufficient for your needs. That's Timothy, 1 Timothy 6 and 5, where he says, having food and raiment, let us be there with content. If you want more than that, you're in real trouble. So he goes on with that. Through the years, we have built up a laborious dialectic, you notice, to justify and even sanctify the ways we follow. Remember that passage in Timothy 6 and 5, where he says the people not only say that wealth is allowed by God, but that gain is godliness. Gain is a sign, that's an Anglo-Saxon tradition too, prosperity and riches, that gain is godliness. Keep away from such people, he says. There is a pitfall and a snare. They're led into many foolish and hurtful desires. They're never satisfied. What's called many foolish and hurtful lusts, and in the days, but lust is epithymia, means desire to own things, get all sorts of things. You're never satisfied. You always got to get more. That's what it leads to. It says, which has led many people to the faith. But can they say that gain is godliness? No. Well, God rejects all our rationalizations about this business, it says in 16. See, this is one thing in which we're never going to agree on. Great guns. All we're hearing about these days is the economy, and the columnists never agree. I mean, three, four, five Nobel laureates will take absolutely opposite stance, using the same data, and with the greatest of confidence, and the predictions is worse than weather prediction, as far as that's concerned. Anyway, but he rejects our rationalizations, our fervid moral tone, our moving emotional appeal to character and virtues requisite to achieving success. The same virtues apply in all other lines. It takes the same virtues of consistency and courage and persistence and imagination, enterprise and so forth, to be a successful in military or athletics or art or scholarship or crime, to be an international human thief, I say, or a successful hijacker, requires the very same qualities as to succeed in anything else. The fact that those qualities of character are necessary does not endow any particular line or calling with sanctity, not at all. We're supposed to have these in whatever we do. And we say that this justifies what we get, and so forth. Now here, let's get specific, the Lord tells us here. Forget your carefully reasoned systems. This must needs be done, he says, in my own way, not yours. After all your economic theories and so forth, for that. It must be done in mine own way. And behold, this is the way that I've... What my way is, you ask what it is, I'll tell you. That I, the Lord, have decreed to provide for my sake, that the poor shall be exalted and that the rich be made low. Boy, that sounds like a Robin Hood philosophy or something like that. Incidentally, this puts it right on the line. It's a passage which I have not heard too often from the stand. And you'd think that'd be final, because it couldn't be more clear, more definitely stated. It's not without reason that the Lord goes out of his way at this point to remind us with the greatest emphasis that he's quite aware that this is not the kind of economy people are going to like. This does not appeal to much at all. It's not supposed to. If you're doing things my way, he says, you're not doing things your way. That's the first thing we accept, is the law of God, that I will do things your way, which is the law of obedience, to hearken to me, which is the law of sacrifice. And connected with this is the law of consecration, which he's talking about here. And so, a lesson in basic economics, 17th verse. For the earth is full, and there is enough and to spare. I have prepared all things, and don't produce them. It's very rarely that a person sells anything he produces today. The craftsman has become a rarity, the real craftsman, as far as the producer is concerned. Everything is manipulated today, if you know it. It's miraculous, because things are turned over to a technology which takes care of processing. It's nature that produces things. God gives us the things, then we process them with great technical know-how, which takes very little manpower, as far as that goes. We're doing it by the sweat of our brow. And then we manipulate the stuff, all sorts of paperwork and razzle-dazzle and so forth. But the farmer knows that what he produces, God gave the harvest. He's the one that produced it, after all. And they cultivated all that. Well, and I have given unto the children of men to be agents unto themselves. Well, he says, it's yours, and I put it here, and the earth is full, and there's enough to spare. Now, what are you going to do with it? That's up to you. It's up to you. How are you going to administer it? God put these things into my hands, says Brigham Young, and he says it very often. And he put these things into our hands to see what we would do. And it's a test. Can we be trusted in the eternities if we abuse each other, and if we abuse the gifts that God has given us? How far can we be trusted with these things? Imagine if we were to be trusted with infinite power to produce and to distribute or anything else, what would you do? How wisely would you administer it? We don't make a very good accounting of ourselves here, do we? For if any man, therefore, see, I've left it to yourself, therefore you're responsible for how you treat it. You're an agent to yourself. First he says, I've given it all to you, there's enough for anybody, now how are you going to divide it up? It's up to you, he says. But if any man take of the abundance which I have made, it's not your hard work that created it at all, and in part not his portion according to the law of my gospel, I've given you the law, to the poor and needy, he shall with the wicked lift up his eyes in hell and be in torment. Again, it's the case of Lazarus and the rich man. Dives went to hell and lifted up his eyes and saw Lazarus in the bosom of Abraham. And Abraham replied and said, yes, while you were on the earth, you were allowed to take anything you wanted. You could do anything you wanted. You had your pleasure there now. This is it. He says, nothing kept you. You can grab as much as you want. That's perfectly legal as far as the Lord is concerned. He lets you do it. Definitely. Don't expect to have treasures in heaven if you have treasures on earth. You lay up the treasure in the one place only. You can't have them both. So the rich man here is given his free agency in dealing with everything. He's not forced to give anything to Lazarus at all. In that case, what would become of the test? The answer is there's no way of avoiding the test. We cannot avoid this test. All human beings constantly make demands on other human beings. The awareness of those demands and the reaction to them determine the place in God's register here, how we react to our demands upon each other. Now, the properties of the order are to be put to use, tells the 19th verse. One piece to supply Sidney Rigdon with means for his support while he's laboring in my vineyard. The order must always operate it as with united consent. It's still an order. See the 21st verse here, and the 22nd verse following. The home and the tannery lot for Sidney Rigdon for his stewardship and a blessing for his seed after him. Martin Harris is to get another lot for his stewardship, the one that belonged to John Johnson, and his money is to be turned over to Joseph Smith for the building of the kingdom. Frederick G. Williams is to get a lot. He got into some trouble about that and left the church as a result of it. Cowdery gets a lot for himself and another for his father. Williams and Cowdery get the printing office, not as their property, to do with as they please, however, and this shall be their stewardship. That inasmuch as they are faithful, I will multiply blessings upon them. A stewardship is not an unlimited grant, you know. You must be faithfully administered according to specific instructions. This is the beginning of the stewardship. This is, I'm just starting you out here, he says in the 32nd verse and the 33rd verse, and if you're faithful, more will be added. Even a multiplicity of blessings. How does it work? Well, he gives some cases here, the case of John Johnson. He's to sell certain lots, John Johnson. As it shall be made known to him, I notice by the various sources and controls we have here. By the voice of the Spirit, first of all, John Johnson has to live so that he will be led by the Spirit and know what to do with these things. He's to sell them. But then it must be according to the counsel of the order. The thing must be discussed with the order. And then it must be voted on, and by the voice of the order, even though it's John Johnson who's administering this particular property. When he's moved by the Spirit how to go about this, having first been commanded by direct revelation, here's the revelation to John Johnson. Commanded by direct revelation, he presents his plan for discussion, the plan that comes into his mind through the guidance of the Holy Spirit, he presents it for discussion, and then the whole order votes on it. And this is stewardship, for 37th verse, and this is the beginning of the stewardship which I have appointed unto. Now, Newell K. Whitney and the store is to do the same way, and with certain lots too, and it's all done as part of a single general undertaking, with the knowledge, advice, and consent of all those concerned, meaning the entire church. Everybody is in on every deal at the point. Everyone knows what's going on. It's all open above board. After he's decided to make the deal, then it's discussed, and then it's voted on. Oh, the code names, just like talked about Barak and so forth. He's going to tell us here, don't let this out to anybody, the Gentiles, don't let them know. No, their codes, they're covering up. They're talking about the shine line, the printing press and so forth, using these various names. Yes, their names arbitrarily chosen, though they usually have some rather significant meanings to designate things, because this was not to be let out. These revelations were not published at this time. And that's right. And when they were talking about, sometimes he's called Enoch, sometimes he's called Barak Eil, the explanation is now put in parentheses, were not supplied in the original time. An outsider would not know who they were talking about, or is not supposed to. Though he says, don't let any of these things out. This has to be kept among yourselves very strictly. And yes, he tells us here a little later on, he says, I want you to do business in your own names, both collectively and individually, in your own names as a cover-up. They go underground, see. The order is not abolished here, but it goes underground. A certain way. It's a very interesting arrangement they have here. No, stewardship is responsibility at all. The steward assists in the administering of wealth, but not his own. It's entrusted into his hands as belonging to the generality, all of whom are involved in the gospel. And the same, here's another name for Joseph Smith, is Gazelem. Another very interesting name is Gazelem. It does mean seer stone. It's not a Hebrew word. It's not a Greek word. It's Aramaic. It's a pretty good word. Now comes an important announcement in the 47th verse. We have to move along here. We never get here. The law is rescinded. But what do they say? No, they just make a few major corrections here. The tie between Missouri and Ohio, they're not officially now included in the same administrative district, you might say. You shall no longer be bound as a united order to your brethren of Zion. They're not bound to the brethren back out on the frontier. That is, the communities of the East and West shall act, except in a limited sense, separately. Except in this limited sense. They shall organize and be called the United Order of the Stake of Zion and the City of Kirtland, in the East, and of the Stake of Zion. And it's called Shidaha there, which is very interesting. That's just a code name. It's taken from Abraham 3:13. It's the Egyptian word meaning the sun and his eternal round, all that he shines on, which is that's what it means. Perfect in Egyptian word. Well, we could have some. We won't go on again. The Shinaha is a very interesting word, though. But I say it should be discussed in connection with the book of Abraham and not with this one. It's perfect to give word. And the brethren out west, after they are organized, shall be called the United Order of the City of Zion. So we have two United Orders. You have to break between the United Order of Shinaha and the United Order of the City of Zion. The order in this 49th verse definitely goes underground. Henceforth, the organized in their own names. They don't operate in the name of the order or openly like that, but they operate as independent individuals entirely. So it's going underground. Though they're still bound, they still have to keep the rules and so forth. And they shall do their business in their own name and in their own names, whether they're acting corporately, whether they're acting together as a companies, or whether they're acting as individuals. They shall be by their regular names, their legal names, so as not to involve in this. Why? For security. 51st verse. This I've commanded to be done for your salvation. You're saved your neck, in other words. In view of what's happened, no, it's in consequence of being driven out of far west. You don't know what's happened, but this brought on you. In consequence of their being driven out, and that which is to come. You saw worse was ahead. So they would now have to, say, go underground to operate under their own names now, in consequence of what's happened and what is still to happen more ahead. The reason is, they brought it on themselves. It's not working. 52. The covenants being broken through transgression by covetousness and feigned words. There's no place for self-promotion in the United Order. It will not do to pay at lip service while you're serving yourself. And again, you break a covenant, but you still have to keep the other party between two parties. Not the same thing as an oath. It's a different covenant. But here, when you break it, doesn't mean you still don't have to pay. You still don't have to fill the conditions. If you haven't kept the covenants of contract, if you have to, if you put in a bad job of plumbing something, you've got to tear it all out and put it in all over again. So they're going to have to do this. They're going to have to go do it all over again. Therefore, you are dissolved as united order with your brethren. From this time forth, they're not bound as formally to each other, you know. Through obligations, though obligations, he says, the loans already entered into must be paid off, as your circumstances will admit, and the voice of the council direct. They're still operating under the voice of the council, you know, but they're not united to each other now. But what about the stewardship in the 54th verse? That still holds. All these properties are mine, and remain so. If not, you're found hypocrite, because you've already covenanted. That should be so. And the covenant which ye have made unto me are broken. Covenants made with God must be observed, and those are the covenants we've made, and sooner or later we have to pay. And if the properties are mine, way back to the next verse, the 55th verse, and if the properties are mine, then you are stewards. Otherwise, you're not stewards. There's no stewardship outside the order, as far as the Lord is concerned. Stewardship doesn't mean just administering whatever your own property is and being responsible for that. Every man's responsible anyway, as far as that goes. No, there's no stewardship. The Lord's talking about stewardship means membership in the order. I have appointed you to be stewards over my house. And that requires you, 57th verse, see, he says he dissolved, but it's still going on, you know. And that requires you to organize yourselves, to get the printing done, for a fullness of my scriptures and revelations which I have given them. The immediate object here is to get the scriptures circulated. See, they have the Doctrine and Covenants out, and get the Book of Mormon circulating, for the purpose of building up my church and kingdom. That's the space, notice that's the specific purpose of the law of consecration, to build up the church and kingdom of God, and the establishment of Zion. There shall be a consecrated treasure. Now he has two treasures. There's a consecrated treasure and you can't touch anything. This is right out of the Copper Scrolls, the Dead Sea Scrolls, which talks a lot about the consecrated treasure. In fact, the passage is quoted by Samuel the Lamanite, extensive quotation. It's a quotation from the Book of Enoch. Interesting way these things run together. Well, there he has this thing. this consecrated treasure, 62nd verse, where the sacred things are sealed, and no man among you shall call it his own or any part of it, for it shall belong to all with one accord. Now this is a consecrated treasure, you're not free to take anything from it. But one among you shall keep the treasure house, being ordained unto this blessing. And this he gives the treasurer's report to the general conference. This is what happens with that. These sacred things are not included in your stewardship. Do not have them, don't touch them, which must be used to build up the kingdom. In this case, it means getting out the standard works. What is in the treasury is still is to be disposed of, the 64th verse, only by the voice of the order or by commandment. The order definitely has gone underground here. But the sacred things of the treasury shall be used only for sacred and holy purposes. In the Copper Scroll of the Dead Sea Scrolls, it talks about the temple treasure and the treasures that people have hidden. And he says, once you've hidden the treasure, it's sanctified, it's consecrated to the Lord. And they hid their treasure because the enemy was coming. They fled from Jerusalem. And the Copper Scroll has a list of places where the treasures were hidden. That's what's very valuable. And it says, when you flee before your enemies and hide up your treasure, you must hide them up to me, with the understanding that if you ever get them again, they're consecrated treasures. They'll be consecrated to the temple, and you can never use them for your own business again. Therefore, you hide up your treasure. Remember what Samuel the Lamanite says? Your treasures are cursed because when you flee from your enemies, you hide them up, and you hide them up not to me. Therefore,